Mormon Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support. Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Transitions. I'm your host, Christy Money. And for many of my listeners, today's guest will need no introduction. Jana Rees is both a writer and editor, maybe best known for her book, Flunking Sainthood, where she explored at length one spiritual practice per month for 1 year, and The Twible, where she summarized the Bible in a series of tweets. And she also has a well-known regular blog called Flunking Sainthood, hosted by Religion News Service, and is well-known throughout the world of unorthodox Mormonism and online Mormonism more generally. So she was recently quoted at length in a piece on NPR about cultural Mormons, and we will be talking somewhat at length about that trend and the appeal it might hold for many of the listeners of this podcast. So, Jana, thank you so much for coming on tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure's all mine. All right. So you were not raised in the church, right? Can you tell us more about how you came into Mormonism?
The short version is I was raised in a family with really no religion at a time long before that was the norm in the United States or even a sort of mainstream alternative in the United States. And so being a nun, N-O-N-E, you know, growing up in the 70s was pretty unusual in the little Midwestern town where I lived. But I was always really interested in religion and would kind of tag along with friends of mine to synagogue or to church just to see what it was like. And when I was 14, I became Presbyterian. I converted on a youth group trip to Wisconsin, a skiing trip, and then had, you know, several years of fairly intense religious experience as a Protestant. In college, I was involved with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which is a really wonderful evangelical Christian organization for college students. That was very formative for my faith. But I was always interested in Mormonism and was certainly reading all the time, very intrigued. I'm actually working on a blog post about this right now because it's the 50th anniversary of Dialogue right this fall, and they're about to have a big celebration. And so Dialogue has asked some bloggers to talk about their own experiences with the journal. And so I've been reflecting on what that was like for me and how important it was for me to kind of quietly, surreptitiously be reading about Mormonism as an evangelical. And then as a seminary student, I went to divinity school to become a pastor. And I would go and sit in the library stacks and just, you know, sit down on the linoleum floor and pull these bound issues of Dialogue down from the shelves. So that was a big part of my education in Mormonism. And it was a long time between the time when I met with the missionaries and I finally decided to join the church. You know, it was a hard decision. I was, as I said, studying to be a pastor, which that makes it awkward, right? I'd also got married to this wonderful Protestant man, and I was, you know, here about to make this big change in the marriage, this big decision to convert to another faith. So it was a really tough decision. And it took almost, I guess, 3 years between the time when I first met with the missionaries and when I was baptized. And I was baptized actually in September of 1993, which, if you know anything about Mormon history, is a kind of significant time. And I was aware of what was going on with the September 6 being excommunicated because I was reading about it in the New York Times. this was, you know, in the days before the internet when we were up to the minute on whatever was going on in the world. But, you know, I was still pretty well informed, and I was writing my senior thesis about Mormon feminism for seminary. So that was a tough time. But I did decide to be baptized, and I'm glad I did. I mean, I've never regretted it. I am still active in the church. I actually was just called into the Relief Society presidency this summer, which has been a hard thing for me after 7 years serving in primary. Primary can be such a refuge. It really can be such an affirming place for people who are not necessarily comfortable with the things that might come out of adult mouths at church, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in that category. So primary was a really fantastic place for me for many years, and I miss it terribly already. So,
oh, I bet. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the story up to now.
Okay. Yeah, I can definitely understand how primary can be an affirming place. And I mean, not only is it can it be a safe refuge, but also if you're feeling that, you know, some of the teachings or policies are pretty obedience heavy, or maybe the follow the prophet is just something that you want to teach more independence, you can do that in primary. Yeah. You have somewhat amount of autonomy, you just teach about Jesus. You know, that kind.
Right. We learned a lot about Jesus, mm-hmm. and then we had snack. You know,
yes.
And
yes.
I'm very into both of those things, Jesus and snack. So yeah. Primary is great.
Me too. Amen to that. All right. So how would you describe your current relationship with church policy, I mean, given your activity?
I am, and this is not simply referencing the LDS church. This is my relationship to institutions, I would say more generally, mm-hmm. that I am pretty skeptical of institutions and how they work. And when I guess I would say not skeptical. I'm a realist about how institutions work and sometimes how they can be mobilized to bring out the very best in people. And sometimes they can bring out the worst in people. And there is a dynamic in Mormonism that I think is, it makes me uncomfortable when people automatically ascribe to the institution holy, beautiful, wonderful motivations for every single thing the institution does. And, you know, I feel like those are decisions that we make on a case-by-case basis. And if you are going to tell me that every decision that the church has ever made was inspired by God, I am going to tell you, no, I don't think so. And let's talk about them more specifically.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that I don't love the church. And I think that for many Orthodox Mormons, that's the part of it that they don't understand. And I get letters pretty often from people who are very upset about something that I've written and don't understand how I could possibly still be active in the church when I am doubting the LGBT policy, for example, or women's roles, or just, you know, small, simple institutional decisions. I do try on my blog to cite what is praiseworthy about the church. That when the church makes a decision that I think is really wonderful and a step in the right direction, I try to highlight that. And I just hope there'll be more of that, you know?
Yeah, one hopes. Yeah. I'm a bit nervous about that, given who's coming up as prophet next and then after that and after that. I mean, I'm hoping for a Holland or Uchtdorf reprieve. that'll be wonderful. But I'm especially worried about what'll happen after that, and that we might not be hearing much good news for a while. But that, again, that's 10, 15 years off, and who knows what the future holds. I share your hope, and I'll have my fingers crossed, because It's just, it seems like hierarchically, it really depends on who is prophet. Now at a grassroots level and what you can do in your community. I mean, that's a whole other story, I think. You know, there's a whole lot that you can do in a space that you can occupy that's mm-hmm. separate from the institutional church or whatever's going on in Salt Lake. But, I mean, sometimes, like, the November policy for LGBT members and their children, I mean, that has ripple effects, you know, all the way down to, you know, a ward in Hurricane Utah, right? I mean, this is the institution definitely had a local effect. But, all that to say, I hope things get better. Okay. Why do you think increasing numbers of heritage Mormons and formerly Orthodox Mormons are beginning to identify as cultural Mormons?
Well, this is the question that is currently driving my research. I'm working on a survey and a book called The Next Mormons. And basically, we are surveying four generations of Latter-day Saints about tons of different questions and their attitudes about religion, about social issues, the temple, garment wearing, word of wisdom, you name it. We've tried somehow to put it in the survey, but trying to understand, has there been generational change on some of these questions? And we will get the results back, hopefully in just a couple weeks here, the initial results anyway. And I will be very interested to see how it comes down. But what we see anecdotally, which may or may not be borne out in the research, but what we see anecdotally is that there has been a generational shift, that millennial Mormons are more likely to either leave altogether or to negotiate their Mormon identity in ways that would have been very unusual two generations prior. So there's been some change.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that identity of cultural Mormon? What that means in your eyes specifically? Because I know it'll mean different things to different people, but how would you describe it?
Well, that's a good point. Actually, since I spoke to NPR and then wrote a follow-up post about, you know, I think it was called Not Orthodox Mormon and Not Ex-Mormon, but Something in Between. Well, there's a lot that's in between. And I heard from several readers who were unhappy with that post, but for completely different reasons. That, to me, was the fascinating part. One person that I do know personally wrote to me and said, you know, I am still active in the church, but I'm not a believer. I still go, but I'm not believing what is being taught. So that's maybe one kind of cultural Mormon. Mm-hmm. I heard from someone else who had the opposite story. You know, I don't go, but I do believe. Well, that's another kind of cultural Mormon. And then I just heard from someone else who was, let me see if I can actually pull that up, because let's see. I had made a comment that focused on what I see as a kind of polarization in the language. I said that to hear the LDS Church and at the other extreme, ex-Mormons frame this narrative, there is an on-off switch between activity and non-activity. Either people are active or they're not. Either they believe in the church or they don't. Either they are in or they are out. And so in the post, I was trying to challenge that dichotomous thinking by saying there is this huge middle ground. But this reader was saying, you know, as a former bishop, that he believes that the church is making a very concerted effort to root out the word inactive from the church's vocabulary and to emphasize these kinds of shades of less activity and to minister to people in whatever circumstance they find themselves. And I hope that that is true. You know, if that is true, that this is the official message now of the church, I have heard that somewhat, but a lot of people are not getting that memo. And part of that is not the church's fault. I think part of that is just human nature, that we have this wonderful drive in us somehow to define our community. And sometimes the fallout of that, the very negative fallout, is that we are too eager to make assumptions about people who are in any way slightly outside how we define that community. So, but I have to disagree with this writer who emailed me, and, you know, this person, and say that if the church is trying to make a concerted effort to not call some people inactive, I'm not seeing it play out in action. And I'd love to hear stories about people who are. Maybe that's just my area. That's always the case, that we may be making, you know, extrapolating something to be global when it's actually a fairly local phenomenon.
I can just speak personally, too, that at least here in Georgia, it's similar to what you're experiencing here in Ohio. There is a pretty important local distinction between active, inactive, and then efforts to reactivate.
Yes,
the inactive,
that's of every ward council meeting, you mm-hmm. know, is about finding people and it out of the goodness of people's hearts. You know, this is not just a manipulative, let's get everyone active so that they're exactly like us. It's sincere. Let's help people. Let's help them pay their bills and raise their kids and be happier people, stronger people, more secure financially and spiritually as well. So it's well-intentioned, but there is still this pretty clear divide, I think, between people who are active and people who are considered to be inactive, however mm-hmm. they consider themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've heard people refer to these, you know, among the spectrum, the Mormon spectrum, as maybe, you know, cafeteria Mormons or Jack mm-hmm. Mormons. The thought of cafeteria Mormons, I love that term. I think we're all cafeteria Mormons. But
yeah, some of us are just more honest about it than others.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I guess what I would say to other people is that this is a decision that you have to make with your own families. And if you have church leaders who are willing to dialogue about this, even if they don't agree with you, that's huge progress right there.
It is.
It just takes a lot of courage. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to say, go into a bishop's office and say, I know this works for you, but it's not working for me, and I need to find a solution that will work where I feel like I can feel good about the contributions that I'm making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes a lot of guts. It's true. And I'm really glad you're talking about this, because I think there are a lot of people on the Mormon spectrum who, you know, that maybe that's something that's holding them back from, you know, participating more in the community if they'd like to, or maybe they're missing the community, but just this issue is really, really difficult. And we're raised to have a very, you know, black and white.
Well, and there's also a fear factor. I think, I hope that what you're saying is true and that people will feel empowered, that there are options. But I also know from experience as a blogger that what can happen is that someone will hear this and will contact my ecclesiastical officers and superiors and say, how could you possibly give this woman a temple recommend and a calling in the Relief Society presidency? That has happened. And it's really sad that this happens, that there are people that kind of feel they have to be the police force for Mormon orthodoxy and orthopraxy. But that's kind of a reality. So,
yeah, I can. That exact thing happened to me, actually. So hopefully your leaders know you really well. I just moved here, so they didn't know me very well. But it sounds like you have a pretty good relationship with your leaders, and that they know you and they know your heart. And
well, they're great people. You know, mm-hmm. I honestly have been very, very fortunate in the bishop roulette game that we talk about. And part of that probably is because I live in Ohio and we're just so desperate for people. It's a reality of living in we are one half of 1% of the population. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of challenges. My ward encompasses a significant part of the urban core of Cincinnati. And so we need everybody. No one is dispensable here in the church. So I'm grateful that I don't live in Utah for people who live in Utah. But, you know, I think it's just a different experience.
Oh,
when
yeah.
I have people who've lived here and then have moved on to Utah, who are these amazing people, and then they don't get callings. Here, people have two callings, and it's yeah. And you can have all kinds of callings here that you never would be given when you lived in a Mormon majority area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I often tell myself I'm really glad I'm not living in Utah, or count my blessings as much as I. Well, I mean, it's complicated, right? You know, my family's in Utah, and so, like, I have so many good memories of Utah. Whenever I see the mountains, I get really homesick, and, you know, I just have this, well, in Mormon parlance, this burning in my bosom about how much I love, you know, my people and, you know, where I'm from. At the same time, yeah, I would have an incredibly hard time with the culture and, I don't in leadership roulette. You know, who knows if I'd win it or not. And for the record, my leaders here in Georgia, they're very nice people too. They're good people. They just didn't know me very well because we had just moved. And it's so interesting too, because we are talking about how, you know, culture can be very different, you know, depending on where you're living. And I remember in my more Orthodox days, my husband first introduced me to Joanna Brooks, and he talked about how, you know, she loves the, or maybe self-identifies as cultural Mormon. She loves the culture. And I remember thinking, well, I think I might've said it too. And I was pretty, I didn't hold back. I think he said something like, well, I wouldn't be in the church just for the culture. I don't like the culture. It's the doctrine that I know is true. And now on the other side of it is a more of a transitioned Mormon, and, you know, I'm so far from Orthodoxy. It's the culture and the heritage is still something that I identify with. And so I see what Joanna was saying five, 6 years later.
Interesting. Well, everyone is in a different place on this journey. I've been rereading Barbara Brown Taylor's book, Leaving Church. I don't know if you've heard of the book or of her. She lives in Georgia, actually. You might.
Oh, yeah, her name sounds familiar. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So in Leaving Church, she describes not really leaving her church, which is the Episcopal Church, but leaving the priesthood, and what a monumental decision that was for her. And so many of the things that she says, even though they're in a different tradition, and even though she was ordained clergy, will be familiar for anyone who is navigating this path of renegotiating, not necessarily leaving full activity or anything like that, but just renegotiating and thinking about a lot of different things, thinking about tithing, thinking about Sabbath keeping, thinking about church activity and how you raise your children. All of these are questions that you need to figure out, and your answers will change over the course of your spiritual journey. That can be bewildering as well. Just when you think you have it figured out, then something changes, and that's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. It really is. Well, yeah, thank you for sharing that. So do you think being a cultural Mormon is a good position for people to take? And if so, why?
Yes, I do. If they need that middle space, and a lot of people do need that space.
Yeah.
I can't give advice, you know. I am not qualified to give advice to people I know, let alone to strangers. But speaking for myself and also speaking for people I do know well, having choices, feeling empowered to be yourself is a fantastic thing. You know, I know people who finally decided, okay, well, I will continue going to church, but I'm going to say what I think and not hide. And I'm going to call people out gently and kindly, but I'm going to do it firmly if they say things that I think are out of bounds. And sometimes even the decision to do that, to be able to bring your whole self to church and have your whole self be respected and not hiding, sometimes even that is enough to allow someone to remain and just do so on their own terms. Sometimes it's not enough and they need more distance, and I respect that.
Yes, absolutely. And what you're saying reminds me a lot of what Mehdi Harrison had said on an earlier episode of Mormon Transitions. And I think you two know each other pretty well because she guest blogs with you on your religion news service blog. Anyway, she talked about how bringing her true self to church, not hiding anymore, you know, her true feelings, just being herself wasn't just a way to give back to the community, which I see is an incredible gift, really, to your community, to let yourself be seen and to let others know that they're not alone. So, I mean, it is altruistic, but she corrected me and said, well, I mean, yes, it may be altruistic, but for me it was more, it was really important for my own survival. She said that I do this because, I mean, she talked about dying inside, really, week after week, not able to bring, you know, who she was, and you know, all her beliefs, lack of belief, just, you know, all her opinions about the November policy, all that it was really important to her for her own survival that she do that. And I mean, I think it's incredibly brave, and you know, if you're going to stay, I think, you know, that's the way to do it.
And so to be Mormon on your own terms, I say that a lot, is just something that can be, I think, an important process to see, you know, will this work? I think it's good to give it a try, so that you don't have any regrets, like, oh, you know, could I have made it work maybe if I just brought my full self to, you know, to my community. And I think a lot of it's community roulette too, not just leader roulette. Like, will the particular combination of, you know, people be accepting? Will they know you well enough to not see you as a threat?
One of the things that intrigued me about some of the Pew research about Mormons, in the religious landscape survey, Mormons are just one part of that, but, in terms of people who leave Mormonism, it's a pretty low number of people who then get involved with another religion or join another religion. Most people who leave Mormonism just are considered to be, they will say nothing in particular when asked, what are you religiously, on a survey. And I found that really interesting. We have a couple of follow-up questions on our survey that maybe can nuance that a little bit and find out what's going on there and why. I wonder if there, you know, in some of the oral history interviews that I've done so far to support, you know, qualitatively what we're doing quantitatively with the book, it has come up among people who have left. One guy told me that one thing that he seems to have internalized about Mormonism is this sense that other churches are somehow broken, and that he's not interested in joining another religion. Mormonism is so kind of all-encompassing that it's how he defines himself, even if he's not active in the church. And that's different, I think, for people who leave other religions that are not quite such a huge identity marker. Mormonism has implications for what you eat and what you do every day of the week, practically, how you raise your children, how you spend your Sunday. All of these questions are things that have to be decided. And it's really tough to then have the trust to say, sure, I'm going to try this other religion and this other faith institution when I'm hurting so much about what happened the last time. That's a lot of trust.
It is. You're right about it being all-encompassing. And I think it can complicate things even more that, you know, from, you know, right out the gate when we're taught, I mean,
for those who served missions or, you know, received the discussions like you, you know, the first, you know, one of the first things you're taught is that in the first vision, right, that Joseph heard that all other religions are wrong. So when you're starting with that assumption, in the very early, you know, parts of the conversion process, I mean, in primary too, I mean, that's what we hear about. You know, Joseph went to pray and found out that he should join no other religions. It's understandable that you get that black and white thinking about all other religions. Combine that with, like you said, it's that Mormonism is the very air you breathe, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're transitioning, you can be kind of wary of jumping into yeah. something else. When something my husband and I talk a lot about is, and because we have really young kids, we've got four kids, and mm-hmm. you know, having a community is still really important to us. And you know, because it's just so hard to raise four kids just, you know, completely on an island. You can't do that. It's good to have a village, right? So we often talk about how it can be hard for especially young Mormon families to try, you know, another spiritual community, because we were so enveloped in, you know, callings and you got to be all in. And when I think, like a lot of other communities, they're just happy if you show up, right? Yeah. you don't have to believe everything.
Breathe, yay!
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're just like, hey, nice of you to come, and so you don't have to be all in the same way. Like Mormonism is just it's kind of, well, I wouldn't say totally unique. I mean, similar dynamics in maybe Jehovah's Witnesses or some maybe more evangelical. Yeah, very more have the fundamental flavor to it, but yeah, it's so interesting, right? That it's hard to trust another community after, you know, being so enveloped in that, being told everything that you need to do. When yeah, it's not always like that, you know, on the other side of the fence. Anyway. I'm really curious about your data, and I can't wait to read about it. When will the book be out?
Good question. Good question. So the first thing that will happen is that this fall there will be a few blog posts highlighting some of the data, probably like the political data, since that's very timely. And we'll see. Also, we have two questions on the survey that break down people's feelings about the November policy from last year. One is, how do you feel about the first part of this, where people who are in a same-sex marriage are identified as apostate and require a disciplinary council? The second part, how do you feel about children of same-sex marriages not being eligible for baptism, et cetera? And so hopefully, if that data is available, and I think it will be in time, then I'll do a one-year anniversary post to see how that breaks down generationally, and whether there is a different generational view of both parts of the policy. So that would be interesting, I think.
Oh, yeah.
The next thing that will happen is that Ben and I will write up. This is Benjamin Knoll at Center College, who has been, he's a social scientist, has been so helpful and instrumental in helping design this survey. He and I will work on the executive summary that people who donated more than $100 to the survey will receive by the end of the calendar year, some of the key facts and research, and then the book. So this is, you know, like boom, boom, boom. We have a lot of hoops to jump through between now and then. I'm also under contract now to write another book that's due in March, so I have to be mindful of that.
Oh, wow. You are definitely busy. So I'm really glad you took the time to talk to me. This is exciting. I can't wait for that data.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. So with the remaining time we have, I know it's not much, but I'm just curious if you think that this broader trend of identifying as cultural or heritage Mormon is a net good not just for individuals, but for Mormonism at large.
I do. I think the bigger the tent, the better. I do think that we need a better vocabulary to describe what's going on, and whether it's heritage Mormon, cultural Mormon, we really have an infinite variety. But I would love to see a more thoughtful engagement of some of the language that we use.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think? When you say heritage Mormon, I'm assuming that you mean you're someone who grew up in the church and possibly descend from pioneer stock, and yet you want to claim that heritage, but you don't necessarily claim involvement in the institutional church. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes. Yeah, the institutional church in Salt Lake City at this point in my life. Yeah, the November policy just hit me hard.
I mean, it hit me so hard that I put tremendous thought into the effects of the policy on my children, you know, because I have four kids, four and under, and I couldn't help but think, you know, what if one or more of them were gay, and you know, what effect would that have on their psychological well-being long term? To grow up in a church that would reject them. My husband and I, you know, felt to a much much smaller extent, you know, what rejection from one's tribe feels like, you know, for being a misfit, for being different, and I just couldn't imagine that same fate for my kids. I wanted them to have options, you know, to you know, that they could choose Orthodox Mormonism or not. That it's up to them, and you know, not raising them in orthodoxy, I felt was our way to do that. Anyway, for what it's worth.
And but I still love my people, and yeah, I do come from pioneer stock on both sides of my family. So that's an, you know, an important part of my family history that I want to still hold on to. I don't know if I mentioned before in an earlier podcast, but that my twins run in my family. So
really?
Mm-hmm, yeah. So my twins are 8 months. I have twin siblings, boy and girl. So boy and girl twins, I should be more specific, run in my family. And my great, great grandfather and aunt, I believe, they were born during the anniversary of the Pioneer celebration in Utah. Then they're all from Utah. It was the Pioneer Jubilee. I think that's what they called it. And so one twin was named William Pioneer, and his sister was named Jubilee.
Wow.
Yeah. So I mean, it's who I am, and yeah, I don't think that's going to change. And you know, we'll see what the future holds. Just yeah. Right now, I even still culturally, to an extent, like I don't drink or have coffee either, or smoke, or like a lifestyle. It's pretty similar. It's just, I'm still a believer. I'm just interested in helping people along their Mormon journey, wherever it leads. So yeah, that's a long answer to your question about heritage Mormons. Mm-hmm.
Well, we need the long answers. That's part of the issue, that the nomenclature that we have been using requires unpacking. And I like it that you could be very specific about where you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I love your response, the long answers, right? And I hope enough people feel comfortable over time to share their Mormon stories, and you know, all as complicated and as messy as they are. And I think it's really important in the healing process too. And as they process through whatever, you know, whatever is, you know, still hard to let go of. I mean, telling the story can be helpful in that regard. So that's why I do what I do. And I imagine that's why, in part, why you do what you do, and you're collecting all this rich data. That's amazing.
I'm very excited. Mm-hmm. I just, as we've been talking, actually got the finalized survey from Ben. This is survey draft 18. We've been, you know, we've been through this now 18 times and have sent it to many, many people in the field for advice in refining the survey, which has been great. But we just added a couple of new questions and took one away. So up until the 11th hour of going live on the survey, we're still editing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that just shows you're doing it well. It's the refining process and that you're being flexible and wow, this is, and we're watching it in real time. I love it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'm sending positive vibes your way for this survey, and as a fellow researcher, I know how time intensive this is. So I wish you the best and can't wait, like I said.
Thank you. Well, it's been an education for me because I was trained as a historian and not a social scientist. So mm-hmm. This is new to me. And how do you word a survey? How do you avoid what they call a double-barreled question, where you're kind of really asking two different things, like, do you pray and read the scriptures every day? Well, someone might pray every day but not read the scriptures every day, so that's a double-barreled question. I've had to learn all of this from scratch, and thankfully I've had some amazing guides along the way to keep me from making rookie mistakes. But I have nothing but respect for social scientists now for how much work goes into creating a very thoughtfully created, that's redundant, but a thoughtful survey that can have accurate measurement and a really strong representative sample. It's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Double-barreled questions. So I learned about it in grad school, but we need a constant reminder even then. So, yeah. All right. Well, again, thank you, Jen. It's been an honor to talk with you.
Thank you, and best wishes with your journey.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. Well, I believe in love and I live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody is wondering.